Name is Mark Blakey, and I'm here today with Bill Miller, who's an expert in the area of sensory processing disorder. Now, Bill has had a very interesting career history. He's worked as a developer for NASA, and he's also a Grammy-nominated audio engineer. And more recently, he's known for a range of sensory processing therapies that he's developed himself. Bill can probably tell you a little bit more about those in a minute, but first I'm very curious, Bill, how did you get into the world of working with kids with sensory processing disorder?
Well, first, Mark, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. It's a real honor. And I would just like to say that this is a long, it's a lifelong pursuit of mine to help children with brain injury and with sensory processing disorders. It's when I was 12 years old, my older sister, who was 8 years older than I, had her best friend had a child with Down syndrome, and that profoundly affected me back then. And I was greatly saddened by this child, and so all through my life, I have paid attention to people who have neurological issues, and I've always wondered if there was something that could be done more that could be done to help them. I am a, as you say, Grammy-nominated audio engineer. Back in the 1970s, I studied psychoacoustics. I've recorded many, many artists, major jazz artists and rock artists and other artists, as well as presidents of the United States, George Bush and Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. And back in the 70s, was interested in psychoacoustics, and that is the process by which people perceive sound and how we identify sounds and how we process sounds in our brain. And so in the middle 1970s, I began teaching audio engineering, and I taught college level audio engineering courses for about 30 years. And in the middle 1980s, my wife and I, before we got married, decided we wanted to homeschool our children, and she decided to take courses at an institute in Philadelphia that was teaching parents of well children how to teach their children from birth. And they also were involved in a very big way with parents of brain injured children. And the director of this institute was Glenn Doman, who's recently died. He died this year. And they learned from brain injured children how to enhance the neurological capabilities of well children, and they learned from well children what the benchmarks should be and how they should help brain injured children develop. And so I was exposed to many, many, many children. Eventually, in 85, I joined their board of directors and spent 18 years studying brain injured children very, very intensively on a full-time basis, and learned a lot about brain injury and sensory processing disorder. I'm also as professionally a designer of software. I designed the first game that was ever developed under a Space Act agreement with NASA. And I've also designed systems engineering software for the Constellation program. So I have essentially three different backgrounds. I have my audio engineering background, I have my study of brain injured children, and I have my software development background. And that all came together to develop the first disc-based listening therapy program in 1995. I created something called Electronic Auditory Stimulation Effect CDs. Now, I had learned at the institutes, I had met at the institutes a young man named David Boguski, and he had a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, and he was desperately, desperately auditory hypersensitive. And his family was terrified to make a noise in their house. They literally tiptoed around the house. In fact, sometimes they would walk with pillows on their feet, literally. And if David heard a noise, something happened outside, he would break into, he would melt down. And eventually they were living in a hostage situation. And when they had come to the institutes should be best known for their work with sensory processing disorder, actually. Because within just a matter of a few weeks, using woodblocks and air horns and transient, highly intense transient sounds, I watched carefully. I was there. I was with David every day. I was watching the process that the therapist went through to help him habituate to noise. Within just a few weeks, they had David listening and hugging, making contact, eye contact with his mother when this young man was 12 or 13 years old at that time, and his legs were twisted around behind him, and he was maybe 80 pounds, and yet his mother was ecstatic, over the moon, happy, because their family was no longer terrorized by his hypersensitivity. And so that was fascinating to me, having studied psychoacoustics for 15 years up to that point. And I became intensely aware that we don't all perceive sound in the same way. And if we don't all perceive sound in the same way, we can't all perceive light and touch and heat and cold and taste and smells. And though this began back then, a journey for me to try to understand sensory processing, how it works, and how sensory processing disorders can affect literally the entire population. We like to speak of the spectrum that children with autism are on because they can be different. The fact is that we are all on a spectrum of neurological organization. Some of us better than others, some of us not as well as others, some of us severely hurt, some of us in coma, some of us on the other end with superb neurological organization, and those are the lucky ones. Those are the ones that have had the right conditions to help their brains develop in the right way. So that initial meeting with David Bogusky and his family led me to many years of study, and about 10 years later, having observed other programs similar to what the institutes were doing, called AIT, Tomatis and Berard, I created the first disc-based program called Electronic Auditory Stimulation Effect, or EASE, CDs. And that was in the early 1990s. Yeah. Yes, go ahead. Oh, I think we just had some feedback there. So in the early 1990s, I created that first CD, and it began to be utilized by therapists. And eventually it has come to be used by 10,000 therapists around the world. It's being used by a group called Vital Links in a therapeutic listening program. And we have sold close to 100,000 of those CDs around the world. Not wanting to stay in one place, during the period of time that I was developing software for NASA in the 2007 era, I had a period of time where our developers, my team, was ahead of the program a little bit, and so I had some months to come up with another idea. And so mothers had asked me over the years, what can my child do when he's listening to his music? Can he read a book? And I would say, yes, it would be a good idea. If he read a book, kept himself busy, that's fine. Can he play a board game? Yes, of course, he could play a board game. Could he play a video game on the TV? And at that point, it got a little complicated because then there's audio with the video game, and it would be difficult for the child to play the game as long as he couldn't hear the music or the audio from the game. So that's a compromise. And we don't want children listening to the television. We don't want watching TV and having, you know, sounds in the background conflicting with the E's music while they're listening to it. So it occurred to me that I could build a video game, that I had a team capable of doing it, and I could build a simple video game that children could play while they were listening to their E's music. And what I started to think about was what would be an appropriate game for children to play. And I realized that not only could I build a game that was appropriate for little ones to play, but I could actually build a therapeutic game by using the same approach to visual disorientation and balance that we used with auditory stimulation. Now, I haven't actually gone over what E's is, and would you like me to do
that? Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, actually, for our listeners. And
how
it works and why it's effective.
Yeah, so I'm ahead of myself. Well, let me go back just a little bit. Our auditory perception is tied directly to our vestibular perception, because when our organism was a fish many millions and millions of years ago living in the sea, when our ancestors were fish living in the sea, they needed a system of self-protection so that they could orient themselves in murky water so that they could sense vibrations around them and so that they could elicit an instantaneous fight or flight response and escape from a predator. And so basically we had fish with rows of hair cells that went down the sides of their bodies, and when those hair cells were stimulated by vibrations in the water, it would trigger a fight or flight response in the fish. Eventually, that fight or flight response became modulated by the fish's ability to habituate to normal motion in the water, and so it became as much a way of sensing the space around them and sensing vibrations and orienting themselves in the water as it was a raw fight or flight escape response. So when those ancient fish moved out onto land, the sensing cells and the parts of the brain and the nerve pathways that were connected to those hair cells allowed them to orient themselves in water, those cells needed to change now in order to orient themselves into an anti-gravity environment a gravitational environment, as well as a atmospheric environment instead of that heavy water environment. So when we moved out, they actually split. The system split from that single system for the fish into two systems. And one of the systems was our vestibular cochlea and the associated areas of the brain that allow us to orient ourselves in space and to respond with anti-gravity activities. We develop bones that can hold us up. We develop a sense of balance and proprioception. And we also simultaneously, but along a slightly different path, we develop the more refined ability to sense very light vibrations in the much lighter atmosphere of air. And so those two senses developed in parallel with each other, sharing the vestibular cochlea, as well as the nerve cells and some of the parts of the brain that process that information, vestibular and auditory. Now, it's important to remember that.
So just to clarify, vestibular refers to this reflex that comes from the hairs on the fish, the ability to sense the environment around. Is that what you mean by vestibular?
Yes. Our balance. Ability to balance. It started out as the fish's ability to orient itself in water, but as we moved on to land, we needed to be able to stand up and move, and as we did, as our ancestors did move and stand up, the vestibular systems of the brain and in the inner ear and the auditory cochlea, vestibular cochlea, those developed along those two lines, auditory and vestibular, to become better at each job, and they specialized. Yeah. But they still share the auditory and vestibular cochlea, and so they affect each other. So our perception of sound actually affects our ability to orient ourselves in space, and it's actually part of this triad of visual, vestibular, auditory triad that with our bodily functions that we can feel, causing us to be able to sense proprioception. Those things all work together to orient ourselves in space. So if we cover our ears, we do not balance as well. If we cover our eyes, we do not balance as well. And if we become distorted in our vestibular orientation, obviously we don't balance as well. But vestibular orientation is not just a function of the vestibular cortex. It is actually, and the vestibular cochlea, it's actually a function of all three of those items. And very importantly for parents of children on the spectrum, is this going all the way back to the original fight or flight response. Auditory perception has a great deal to do with our ability to respond to our social environment, to our physical environment. It has a great deal to do with our emotional response. That fight or flight response is key and core to our relationship to society, to other people, to our family, and to the way that we respond to emotional stress. And so if we have distortions in our auditory perception, it can affect our balance, it can affect our auditory perception, but it also affects our ability to reason and concentrate. It affects our ability to have an appropriate emotional response as well. Okay. Anything else there, Mark?
No, I think that kind of clarifies it. As far as how that kind of fits into when people develop a disorder around sensory processing,
right,
particularly for the children on the autism spectrum, how does that fit in with the concepts you just talked about the different systems?
Sure. Well, with a typical guy that. Or girl that's on our spectrum, we would see as typically normal development up until maybe 18 months or 2 years, and then we start seeing startle reflexes, inappropriate responses to sound, maybe inappropriate responses to light and touch, and those are overwhelming inhibitions. Those are inhibiting the neurological growth of the child at the time when those start. And so there are key stages of development that are essentially postponed if the child is eventually able to be helped. But sometimes those are just denied. Those development stages are just denied to the child because at the time of the hypersensitivity, the child becomes overwhelmed with sensory information and is unable to naturally and subconsciously habituate to those sounds. So you have a child who is being destroyed by senses. His emotional well-being, his intellectual well-being is being broken and destroyed by being overwhelmed constantly by light and sound and taste and touch and smell. Many of your mothers and fathers are going to recognize these circumstances. So at the time that this is going on, the child is unable to take in the information that they need in order to complete the neurological development of their brain. And so their brain goes into a 2-year stage or a 3-year stage, depending on when this all started to happen. And the child is in duress. And the child has to have normal sensory processing in order to have normal neurological development. And without that, then we have stages of development that don't happen. So for instance, in the child who's nonverbal, the child has to be able to process audio information in order to be able to create audio information. So the sound has to come in first. The sound of voices and language has to be processed in the brain first before that child can then create those same sounds on his own and develop the motor skills, fine motor skills, and be able to develop the ability to speak. And so if you have a distortion or you have a blockage of normal habituation and normal sensory processing at that early age, that's the point at which you can't grow beyond.
By habituation, you're talking about the process of getting used to certain sounds and the brain to absorb certain sounds.
Right. Habituation is a subconscious process of the brain. And essentially what happens is everyone does it. We pay no attention to it. In fact, that is the process. That is the purpose of habituation. Let's say you go home to mom for Thanksgiving or for the holidays, and you for whatever holidays you're celebrating. And you open the front door and there's food cooking in the kitchen, and the smell of the food is just overwhelming and your mouth starts watering and immediately you're hungry. Except your house is full of your family and other friends, and so you go in and you meet people and hug people and you start talking and you get a drink, and pretty soon you don't notice how strong the cooking smells were when you first walked in the house. And the reason is that your brain has sensed that sense of smell. It smelled those cooking food, and initially that was an important piece of information for being in the home. However, after a while, your brain doesn't need to constantly attend to those cooking smells, and starts to attend to the other things that you purposefully and consciously are trying to accomplish. And so you habituate almost immediately. Within the first few minutes, you start to habituate, and within about a half an hour, you've habituated to the smells of the cooking food. Mm-hmm. And everything is fine until the potatoes boil over on the stove, and that starts to burn on the stove, and that acrid smell fills the kitchen, and everybody turns to the stove. And now everyone is attending, because now that smell is important. Something is burning, and it's important to be able to attend to it and you know, put out the fire, okay? And that's your brain subconsciously, constantly sampling all of this information. Your brain samples everything that's in the air around you all the time. It samples everything that's that you can see and hear and feel and taste and touch, but it only attends to the things that are important to you, and it habituates to the things that are not important. And when something comes up, that is important, even in the background, your brain subconsciously will attend to that new stimulus and bring your conscious along with it. The subconscious brings the conscious along with it and says, here, this is something that's important. Let's attend to this and let's figure out what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So that is habituation. We all do it, except the child who has this neurological disorientation or lack of orientation that causes them to be unable to habituate. That's sensory processing disorder. When the child is unable to appropriately process their sensory information, they have only a couple of choices. Their brain only has a couple of choices. One of the choices is to just be constantly in a state of arousal and in a state of fear and frustration and be constantly overwhelmed. And that's where we see a lot of young children. And then eventually the brain figures out, you know, the subconscious or the conscious brain figures out, not the subconscious, because this is a subconscious problem. Mm-hmm. But the brain determines that it needs to block out these sounds. And so we have the development of something called sensory defensiveness. And these children use various techniques. Sometimes they will slap their face. Sometimes they will squeal and make their own sounds. Sometimes they will rock in a chair. Many times these perseverant behaviors are substitutes for subconscious habituation. And it's a child's way of being able to create an environment for themselves that they can predict, that isn't completely random, and that allows them to cope with at least survive in a sensory world. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what we find in an older child. We find that in a 5 or 6 or 10 or 12-year-old child who becomes really, really good at defending against sensory information. And I will get a call from a mother, and mother will say, I think my child needs, you know, your program, but I'm not sure. And I say, well, is your child auditory hypersensitive? And she said, no. In fact, I think my child is deaf. And so then the next question has your child acquired language? And if a parent says, no, my child has not acquired language, then I guess the next question would be, was your child always this way? And usually the answer is, no, my child has not always been deaf. My child, in fact, now is a conundrum because he screams at some sounds and is afraid of lawnmowers and hears airplanes that fly over. But when we talk to him, he doesn't respond. He's unresponsive. And so we have that conundrum, that child who is at one time of the day appears deaf and at another time of the day appears auditory hypersensitive. And that is the child who's sensory defensive, and that's the older child. And so for that child, we need to create a program that can not only help the subconscious process of habituation, but first we have to overcome the sensory defense mechanism in order to get to that process of habituation. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is a good point now to figure out or to describe what electronic auditory stimulation is and how it works, because it's actually pretty simple. Even though our auditory processing affects a wide range of our neurological abilities and processes, it is a pretty straightforward process to affect auditory hypersensitivity or auditory processing and to help a child overcome sensory processing disorder. So if we were standing on the street and a bus pulled up and the brakes squealed, we were standing next to a bus stop, let's say, and the brakes squealed, the first time the brakes would squeal, all of us would cover our ears, or we would cringe and move away from the bus. The second bus that came up and whose brakes squealed, those of us with a more natural subconscious habituation capability would cringe and look unhappily at the bus, but we're not going to run away from the bus because we have the ability to cope with that. However, and by the third or fourth bus, we pretty much ignore the bus squealing. We know what it is. We know it's not dangerous. We know it's an irritant, but we don't have to attend to it all the time. Mm-hmm. The child who is standing with us, who has sensory processing disorder, that child can't habituate in the way that we do. So every time the bus pulls up, it's like the first time the bus pulls up. Mm-hmm. Okay? And yes, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask how do we get beyond this?
Right. So here's the thing. In order to what I first observed at the institutes and what they did with David Bogusky all those years ago was so amazing to me and so simple. First of all, our brain organizes itself around the stimulus that we bring in. So when we see things, when we hear things, our senses bring information to the brain, and the brain processes that information and stores that information, and in the process of using the information actually changes the structure of the brain. So the brain grows by use. Glenn Doman said the brain grows by use just like a muscle grows by use. But if the brain is not getting information to use, or if the brain is injured in getting aberrant information, then it can't grow in a normal way. We have to overcome that. So it is an input to the brain that is necessary. But if sound will cause the child to react in a hypersensitive way, then how do we get sound into the brain without triggering that fight or flight response? And the way is the key to that is three elements. It's intensity, frequency, and duration. So intensity in this case means how intense is the stimulus. If a stimulus to the brain is not intense enough, it will not cause a neurological reaction within the brain. So the stimulus has to be intense enough. However, if the stimulus in this case lasts too long, it will trigger the fight or flight response. So we have to shorten the duration of the stimulus. So we need a very intense but very short duration. And that will keep the stimulus from triggering a fight or flight response, but allow us to get the maximum amount of auditory information into the brain in the most effective way possible to affect a change in the actual neurological function of the brain, create new dendritic connections, and be able to actually change the processing of the brain. And so how often we do this, the frequency part of it, has to do with how many times in a day can we deliver an intense, short duration stimulus to the brain. So we have frequency, intensity, and duration. So what EASE does, and originally what EASE did back in when I first created disc-based listening therapy, is to take a instrumental piece of music, no voices on the music. This needs to be a universal music that doesn't rely on whether a person understands English or understands French. It needs to be universal. That's why we use instrumental music. And we essentially use a low pass filter. And what a low pass filter means is that low frequencies pass through this filter and high frequencies don't pass through this filter. And what that does is when we put music through a low pass filter, it dulls the music down, causes the music to sound muted, maybe somewhat like this. Okay, mm-hmm. So the sound is very soft. And I'll say that again, the sound is very soft and easy on the ears. It is the kind of the background sound. We've caused it to be, because it's soft, it's similar to background sound. But then we, on top of that, we apply a short duration, random, high intensity equalizer. Now, an equalizer is the same in your car. You have an equalizer on your stereo, and you can grab that little knob and you can turn the high frequencies up and make it real bright, or you can turn the high frequencies down and make it very dark. And you can do the same with the bass, and on some cars the same with the mids, and some cars even have 7-band equalizers on them. Now, we use an equalizer that has an extreme amount of boost, and it's triggered by a random number generator, and it allows us to provide for that listener a very soft, mellow music bed, and then to superimpose on top of that bursts of very intense high frequency sound derived from the music. So this isn't noise that, you know, like white noise that we apply. It is actually the actual music itself, but it is changing with this dynamic, very intense equalizer. Now, we are teaching, when an individual listens to an ECD, we are teaching them the skill of habituation. And the way that we teach that is we put the headphones on and we play this nice, pleasant, up-tempo, positive-themed music to them. And then we superimpose on that this very intense, very distracting, very sharp equalizer that causes a distraction. And if we were to allow it to last, let's say, 5 seconds, the child would rip the headphones off their head. But because it only lasts a matter of milliseconds, somewhere between 100 and 1200 milliseconds or so, it's very intense, causes a response in the brain to this intense auditory signal, but it causes the brain to actually change and create new connections, new dendritic connections and perception. But it does not cause the fight or flight response. And so essentially what we're doing is we're spoon feeding small but very intense amounts of auditory stimulation underneath the door, underneath that door that's called sensory defense mechanism, that door that bars other sounds from getting into the brain. We can actually sneak under the door with this very short duration but very high intense auditory stimulation. And in doing so, we're actually teaching the child to listen through these distractions to the music behind them. And that is a skill. And once that child starts to learn how to, and by the way, you can't consciously do this. This is a subconscious skill. But once the child starts to listen through the intense distractions to the music in the background, that skill can then be taken out to a restaurant. And so the child is with their family in a restaurant, and instead of attending to every single drop of a fork on a plate, that child is able to use that same habituation skill to listen to their mother speaking to them and listen to the conversation close by at their table, instead of being driven constantly to distractions by other sounds in the room. Mm-hmm. So that's what ease is. It's really not that difficult are complex to understand. We are teaching the skill of habituation using music as a bed and this equalizer as a distraction, but a very intense, short-term, high-intensity distraction.
Okay.
Nice. So, go ahead.
It was going to lead me on to my next question about really about how successful this has been to kids that work with it, and do you find it works with all kids with sensory processing disorders or?
Yeah, obviously every child is different, and so when a mother calls me and wants me to diagnose her child, like, don't do that, can't do that. You cannot guarantee that this is going to work with every child. However, what we do know is that when we have a child that exhibits these characteristics, we have a good shot with that child. We have a good chance that that child is going to respond positively to this simple therapy, because the child and the therapy, because we're addressing the direct problem that the child has. For example, one of the major treatments for autism is a program that is intent on changing behaviors of the child. And so if a child is behaving what someone would consider badly in a social environment, the therapy is designed for the child to understand what is a better behavior and how to accomplish, and how to behave. However, in my opinion, trying to teach someone how to behave when they are under duress is essentially asking the child to ignore their own body, to ignore the senses that they actually are experiencing, and to behave in a way that is inappropriate. And so here you're saying, behave well when you are under duress. That's really difficult for anybody to do. Mm-hmm. And it is confusing because the child has only their own. We all live inside our senses. We don't really share a world. We live inside our senses, and our world is what is fed to our brain through our senses. And so we're asking a child to behave inappropriately by modifying their behavior without modifying their sensory information. However, if we modify their sensory information first so that they are able to cope with noise and they're able to cope with the world around them, then the reason, the source of their meltdowns and the source of their quote unquote bad behavior, I don't even ascribe to autistic children having bad behavior. They don't. I think that autistic children are behaving completely appropriately. They are mm-hmm. behaving appropriately to their sensory information. But if we can change the information that their brain is getting, or we can change, more importantly, the way their brain responds subconsciously to external stimulus, then changing the behavior becomes almost automatic. Then it's not a struggle to change their behavior, because now that child is actually behaving appropriately to the world around them. When you say, please calm down, well, it makes sense for a child to be calm in a noisy environment if they are not under duress from that noisy environment. Mm-hmm. Now, I stopped before going into the EASE games, and I think I could go back to that if we have time.
Yeah, no, let's go for that.
Okay, so when the mothers would ask me what kind of games could my child play, I realized that not only could I design a game, I mean, I had a team of terrific programmers, and I had just completed designing a big game for NASA, and I was also working on systems engineering and integration tools for the Constellation program. So systems engineering and video games are very much the same. And So I decided that there was something more that could be done besides just giving the child Sudoku, for instance, while they listen to the EASE music. But the point of the game was that they would be listening to their EASE music and they would have an activity. Now, as we just learned, the way that we approach sensory processing in the auditory realm is to create very short duration, high intensity challenges to a child's ability to process audio. So those short duration, high intensity equalization bursts are to audio what flashes of light, for example, might be to our visual realm. Okay. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say I want to design a game that would flash lights in a child's face, but I needed to create a game that would put the child in a challenging visual environment. So the idea was to create a game with bright colors and high contrasts and an environment that was potentially even more bright and stimulating than their natural non-video environment would be. In addition to that, I had studied virtual vestibular environments at NASA as part of astronaut training. The NASA at Johnson Space Center, where my program was centered from, we also work with people at Glenn and Ames and Kennedy on the Constellation program. But at Johnson, they were doing virtual vestibular work with the astronauts in a couple of ways. One was a program in which you could explore the external skin of the International Space Station from thousands of yards back all the way up to the skin of the vehicle and actually be able to turn bolts on the skin of the vehicle. That was really important to me when I made the original game Space Station Sim for NASA, because that itself was a virtual vestibular microgravity environment. And so I determined that I could create a virtual vestibular. Oh, there was also studies going on with Parkinson's patients using virtual vestibular environments to help Parkinson's patients recover their ability to balance after they had lost their ability to balance. So if a Parkinson's 70-year-old Parkinson's patient could learn how to balance using a virtual vestibular environment, I thought, you know, a 3 or 4 or 12 or 16-year-old young person who has vestibular challenges because of their auditory processing should be able to have a much more plastic brain, and a much faster ability to develop those vestibular areas of their brain than a Parkinson's patient. So that was really important. So I decided to build virtual vestibular environment to go along with the auditory environment of the Ease music. And the way that played out was in motion games. So I had the choice of building a first-person shooter where someone was with their gun running across an open field and bouncing around, or a flying or driving game. Now, I wasn't about to start designing first-person shooters for brain-injured children or children with sensory processing disorder or children on the autism spectrum. That was just, you know, a non-starter. So I concentrated on vestibular games. So those became the basis for the Ease games. And so in a vestibular way, if we look at visual vestibular orientation in the same way that we would look at auditory orientation, we would see that we want to constantly be challenging the player to be able to cope with changing environments. So we wanted to have a buggy, let's say, that could bounce around on the environment and constantly challenge that player's orientation in space. And as a matter of fact, as soon as I made the first game, within the first months of game testing, the very first game, we sent it to therapists, and they played the game, and they had their children play the game. And the therapist called us back and said, I don't know. I mean, if I stand behind my clients and while they're playing the game, I get dizzy. And I said, perfect. That's exactly what we want. We want to challenge the vestibular orientation. That means we want to make you dizzy. And when we can make you dizzy with the game, you are growing the ability to reorient yourself and keep yourselves from becoming dizzy. So Ease games are best played standing up. Ease, okay? So we ended up with, in addition to this vestibular disorientation and challenges to a person's vestibular orientation, we actually added other things such as visual tracking. The games have targets in them, or they have objects in them, and your job playing the game is to drive across the field and tag an object. Usually tagging target, a red target or a green target in the far field. And when you're driving the buggy or flying the airplane, you have to keep your eye on that object behind the hill, and you have to remember where that object was, drive up over top of the hill and try to find that object on the other side. So there are intellectual challenges here as well, as keeping that object in your mind, keeping that object present in your mind while you can't see that object. There's what were called saccadic challenges. There are challenges like smoke and bushes and other distractions that fly up and in your face while you're driving the game to challenge your ability to keep your eyes on the target and to keep your mind on the target as well. And so we have these, it's all about vestibular and visual orientation challenges and overcoming those. And all of those elements, which look like a game to the children, which is critical that it look like a game, that the children be engaged in their own activities, their own therapeutic activities, and have a buy-in, that they are bought in, that this is something that's for them and fun. Those challenges tend to develop the same vestibular habituation, the same habituation for vestibular sense and visual sense that auditory stimulation does for the auditory sense. And so we integrate the three elements. We integrate the visual, the vestibular, and the auditory processing all into one therapeutic environment that looks for the world like a video game to a child.
Wow, that's quite a piece of work.
So, and it works. The games and the CDs were studied at Brunel University in 2011, and the study concluded that the results that they got in the study should be able to be applied to the population in general, that within 30 days of starting to play the video games, that they could document improvements in auditory perception and document improvements in occupational function and the ability to concentrate. There were a lot of, they used a Canadian occupational performance standard tests with the children, as well as responses from parents, and correlated that all together using data that we collect in the game. Because I'm a data guy, I like to collect as much information as possible and present it. And actually, both the games and the Ease app were designed for researchers. They were designed to make researchers' job as easy as possible by collecting as much performance data from the game and from the apps as possible, so researchers could use sophisticated data processing tools in order to come up with conclusions about the progress of the child using either the games or the apps. So the games are studied. This last year in 2013, in April at San Diego, that study was presented at the AOTA convention. And so we're excited. And there was another study done of the Ease apps. We haven't talked about those. I don't know if we'll get to those today, but the Ease apps are the most, in my opinion, sophisticated. This is the most sophisticated software tool that has ever been developed for children with sensory processing disorder. And that study, there was a study that was published in that was done in 2012 and published in early 2013, that also concluded that the apps worked. And then there's another series of studies ongoing right now. There was a study last summer to further analyze the data from one of the earlier studies, and there's a study ongoing right now with new groups of children. And I guess if someone is interested in reading the first two studies, you could go to our website. Our website is www.easecd.com. That's EASECD.com. And there's a lot of information there, and you can read the full studies if you're interested in reading the full studies. So how's that, Mark?
No, that's great. That's great.
We do it fine.
I think we're almost there, but I'm going to ask you one question we always ask people that we're interviewing. Do you have any advice specifically for parents whose children have sensory processing disorder? Is there any tips that you would give them to kind of take away specifically?
Yes, I think I do. One of the things is to try to put yourself in your child's place. I know that everyone tries to do that, and that is a natural function of a mother and a father. But because a child's sensory perception can be so different from ours, it is a really difficult thing to be able to believe that a sound that we consider to be just a normal, environmental, non-threatening event could be so terrifying to a child. And so if you have a child that is having what other people call tantrums and what are better described as meltdowns, the vast majority of the time we're talking a sensory meltdown. We're talking a child who just cannot cope anymore with the onslaught of sensory overload, and it's not a behavioral issue. So the first thing is your child doesn't have a behavioral issue. Your child has a sensory problem, and if you can overcome this problem, your behavior will improve. Now, the second thing, which seems to be a little counterintuitive, but there are a lot of children out there wearing shooter's headphones to block out sound, and that is a potentially not helpful technique. And the reason for this is that while it is a short-term solution, if you take your child out to the mall and he just cannot handle the sound in the mall, and you put a pair of headphones on him and now he can handle the sound in the mall, that's terrific. That's a short-term solution to the problem. But the better solution is to treat the sensory processing, and then your child can not only cope with the sounds in the mall, but he can also start to accumulate all the data that he needs to accumulate in order to grow his brain to the best ability that he can, to get that brain on the fast track and growing and adapting to the world. So while headphones and blocking sounds, again, can be a good short-term fix, you want to be careful that your child not get addicted to having headphones on, that those headphones should be only a temporary fix and should be put away whenever possible. And you know, that's one of those are the two things. Recognize that your child has a sensory problem and not a behavior problem. And the other thing is to help fix the problem, the sensory problem, instead of covering it up with headphones. And I think if every parent who has a child who is melting down, is having trouble coping, has lost their ability to acquire language, is struggling with balance, who bruises themselves all the time, who has social interaction issues, who seems to have a short fuse, all of those circumstances are actually driven by their interaction with the world and their sensory processing. And once you eliminate that, behavior is a simple thing. Behavior is just showing love and getting love.
Well, that's really great advice, Bill. I think many people forget that the first piece that you were saying about meltdowns, they kind of they see the end result, but they don't actually look and see what caused it earlier on.
Right. If we had a message to the world about children on the spectrum, to the world that don't know the children on the spectrum, my message would be, it's not behavior.
Mm.
We should have a button that says it's not behavior.
Mm. That's true. Well, thanks for that, and thank you very much for being with us today. I hope we see more of you in the future talking about sensory issues. And we're going to add the show notes up with links, so you can find some of the papers Bill was talking about. Thanks again.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I can't thank you enough for that.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you'd like a free copy of our magazine, all you have to do is go to our website at www.autismparentingmagazine and enter your email. Whatever issue is out at the moment, you will get a free copy of. Also, please join us on Facebook at Autism Parenting Magazine and on Twitter at Autism Parent Mag. And you can find me personally on Twitter under hashtag Leslie, LeslieAPMAG for App Mag. Thanks. Have a great day.